Hi everyone, thanks for listening to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, we followed the career of John III of Sweden after he had toppled his brother, Erik XIV, and taken his crown. Much of John's reign was spent fighting the Russians, but the king also invested a lot of time and effort in trying to roll back the Reformation and making Sweden as Catholic as possible again. It didn't really work. It's hardly surprising that the church in Sweden opposed this plan to re-Catholicize the country, but also King John's brother, Carl, was dead set against it. He even protected priests and others who protested against the king's religious agenda. They found a safe space to continue to practice and argue for Lutheranism in Carl's autonomous duchy. After John's death, the crown was inherited by his son, Sigismund, who was a Catholic. Today, we'll see how John's Lutheran brother and Catholic son got along. Surely they'll stick together and cooperate for the good of the realm, right? Episode 83, Worst Uncle Ever. The eldest son of John III and his Polish-born wife, Queen Catherine, was called Sigismund after his maternal grandfather. He was born in 1566 at Gripsholm Castle, while his parents were locked up there, his father condemned to death and his mother risking extradition to Russia. When his father became king, Sigismund automatically became the heir apparent to the Swedish crown. He actually also had a good chance of claiming the Polish crown, which he did in 1587. Because of his close connections to Poland and his mother's religious affiliation, young Sigismund was raised a Catholic. That wasn't an obvious choice in late 16th century Sweden, since the country had cut its ties with Rome and was now an officially Lutheran kingdom. But, as we saw last time, his father had a soft spot for Catholicism and didn't mind that the little baby was brought up to be a Catholic, especially if that increased his chances of bagging the Polish crown. In 1586, Sigismund was supposed to marry a Lutheran princess, but his aunt, the Queen of Poland, torpedoed that plan. She wanted him to marry a Habsburg princess instead, since the Habsburgs were both much more powerful and therefore a better ally, and Catholics, making Sigismund even more electable in the next Polish royal elections. The Polish throne became vacant in December that year, and Sigismund threw his hat in the ring to become the next king. The other leading candidates were the Tsar of Russia and a member of the Habsburg family, not easily defeated opponents. So, in order to ensure his election, Sigismund's camp let people in Poland believe that King John III of Sweden would give Poland Estonia if his son was elected. That wasn't strictly speaking true, but the electors didn't know that, and Sigismund was elected King of Poland in 1587. Before he left Sweden in that same year, Sigismund and his father King John had made a deal called the Kalmar Constitution. It was a document regulating how Sweden and Poland should be governed once John died and Sigismund became the king of both countries. The document stated that Sweden and Poland should be allies in foreign policy, especially against the common enemy Russia, but their respective domestic political systems should be left intact, separate, and not be mixed in any way. When King Sigismund was in Poland, Sweden should be governed by a council of 7 members. The king would appoint 6 of them, and his uncle Carl would appoint the 7th. In especially thorny or important issues, the archbishop and other bishops should be consulted. Senior government functionaries should be appointed by the king from a list of candidates suggested by the council. No tax revenues could be brought out of Sweden, and the king couldn't start a war or sign a treaty with a foreign power without consulting the Riksdag. Sigismund would also have to come to Sweden every other or third year to rule Sweden in person. Since Duke Carl was given such a small part in the government, John was worried his brother would be annoyed if he heard about the content of the document. So the king hid it from him. Great idea, really. Best long-term plan ever. And Duke Carl wasn't alone. The Kalmar Constitution was never presented to the Riksdag either. And a few years later, King John and Duke Carl agreed to scrap the agreement altogether. Meanwhile, when Sigismund arrived in Poland, there was some awkwardness about the question of Estonia. The Polish leading circles pressured Sigismund to give it to them. He refused, protesting that it wasn't his to give away, which kind of made sense. So the disappointed Poles decided to kick the Estonian can down the road until Sigismund became king of Sweden as well. But Sigismund could definitely have had a better start in Poland, and it didn't improve with time either. The Poles thought he was too quiet, stubborn, slow, cheap, and melancholy. They also resented his tendency to rely on favorites. The Polish nobility soon started to regret their choice of king and didn't bother to hide their disdain for Sigismund from the monarch himself. To be fair, he didn't like them much either and started to regret that he'd taken the job to begin with. King John of Sweden also had second thoughts, and he was starting to get seriously worried that the Poles would cause trouble over Estonia once he died. As I mentioned already last time, King John tried to get Sigismund to move back home, but the Swedish nobility opposed the initiative, fearing it would lead to war against Poland. They were also looking forward to running the show when Sigismund would be king, but located far away in Poland and only visiting occasionally. Even the Vatican opposed the idea, because the Catholic hierarchy had come to realize that Sigismund was quite prone to obey counsel from Catholic clergy. They thought it would make it easier to re-establish the church in Sweden, if a king that was willing to do the church's bidding ruled both Sweden and Poland. Sigismund met his father John when he came to Reval in Estonia with that large, but useless army we talked about last time. It took the Swedish and Polish entourages considerable and united efforts to convince Sigismund that he shouldn't return to Sweden with his dad, and instead return to Poland to continue his reign there. When John and Sigismund said goodbye to each other in Reval, that was the last time they ever saw each other. As we covered last time, King John III died not too long afterward, in November 1592. Sigismund was now king of both Poland and Sweden. In other words, Sweden was once again part of a political union created in Kalmar, based on a document of dubious legal validity. Sigismund was obviously keen to go to Sweden to bury his father and to take up the reins of his second kingdom. But, frustratingly, the Polish nobles in the parliament, the Sejm, were causing trouble. They only let him leave Poland on condition that he'd return promptly, within a year, and that he'd make sure Sweden ceded Estonia to Poland. For good measure, they sent along a papal nuncio and some Jesuits to keep track of him. During the upcoming negotiations with the Swedes, led by Sigismund's uncle Karl, the priests were basically the ones who shaped the king's position. Part of this position was to continue the pro-Catholic policy in Sweden by granting Catholics the freedom to worship in Sweden. But the Swedish establishment, led by Uncle Karl, refused. They, in fact, wanted to take a step back from King John's reforms and had decided to scrap the Red Book and stick to a strict Lutheran interpretation of Christianity in Sweden. In the end, Sigismund had to give in if he wanted to become crowned King of Sweden, which he was in February 1594. He did, however, pen a sharply worded protest against the new religious policies in Sweden, but in order not to ruffle any Swedish feathers, he only sent it to the Pope. In his written protest, Sigismund claimed he'd only signed because he had brought too few soldiers along from Poland, but he promised that once he was in full control over Sweden, he'd reintroduce the Catholic Mass in his new realm. In July of the same year, the newly crowned Sigismund had to return to Poland, since he'd promised to do so. He realized his position in Sweden was weak, and that he'd made a lot of enemies, not to least Uncle Karl, who demanded that he be given the title and power of steward of the realm in his nephew's absence. So before the king left, he tried to divide and conquer by spreading the authority to rule in his stead between Uncle Karl, the Council of the Realm, and half a dozen governors who were answerable only to the king. He forbade them all to summon the Riksdag without his expressed consent. Sigismund's analysis of the situation was spot on. Unfortunately, his measures to counteract the threat turned out to be woefully inadequate. Already in 1595, Uncle Karl called a Riksdag in Söderköping. This was against the rules, since only King Sigismund was allowed to summon the estates, but even worse was the agenda Karl wanted to pass. Karl had the Riksdag declare him steward of the realm, forbid the Catholic Mass, and banish all Catholics from Sweden. This was obviously unacceptable to King Sigismund, and when he heard about it, he declared the gathering of the Riksdag illegal and its decisions null and void. But there wasn't much he could do to actually back up his declarations. Uncle Karl was now in charge, and he wasted no time either firing or sidestepping Sigismund's governors. The only one who retained control over his district was Klaus Fleming, who was the governor of Finland, and Klaus Fleming sided with King Sigismund in his struggle with his uncle Karl. At a meeting of the Finnish nobility held in Turku in the beginning of 1596, the Finnish nobleman rejected the decision from the Riksdag, where Karl had been appointed steward of the realm. They sided with the king in pointing out that the Riksdag had been called unlawfully and therefore its decisions weren't valid. Klaus Fleming was a potential threat to Karl's plans. Not only was he the governor of Finland, he was also the commander of the Swedish fleet. Karl decided he needed to get rid of Fleming somehow, and to that end he fanned the flames of discontent among the Finnish peasants. They had actually lodged an official complaint at the Riksdag in 1595 about how Fleming had forced peasants to house and feed soldiers who had been fighting the Russians for the last quarter of a century. This had become a burden that was too hard to bear for many Finnish peasants, who felt unfairly exploited, especially since the war against Russia was over by now, but they were still forced to house and feed a bunch of soldiers. Duke Karl was sympathetic and advised the peasants to defend themselves against the soldiers. Soldiers Fleming had kept battle ready to defend Finland against Karl. The Duke even hinted that he might send troops of his own to assist the Finnish peasants. And that was all it took. In late 1596, a full-blown rebellion broke out among the peasants in Ostrobothnia, that is, the Finnish region on the eastern shores of the Gulf of Bothnia. It's known to history as the Cudgel War, because the peasants were mostly armed with clubs, cudgels and axes, not swords. In the 19th century, when Finnish nationalism started to grow, the Cudgel War became somewhat of a symbol of Finnish national pride, seen as a fight between overbearing and exploitative Swedish aristocrats and native Finnish peasants who had finally had enough, so they took up arms to free themselves of their oppressors. Historians who have liked to interpret the war in this way have pointed to the fact that the rebellion was limited to the eastern part of the realm. West of the Gulf of Bothnia, in Sweden proper, the peasants didn't participate. But the reason for that can just as well be found in the fact that the Finnish side of the kingdom had suffered so much more from the 25-year-long war against Russia. It was Finland that had been plundered and burned by Russian troops, and it was in Finland that the Swedish army had been stationed, fed and housed, when not on active duty in the war. And toward the end of the war, it was mostly Finnish peasants who had been recruited to fill the thinning ranks of the army. So the population in Finland had suffered much more from the war than the peasants in Sweden had. In fact, whereas the number of farms dropped in Finland during these years, it was actually increasing in Sweden, indicating that the Swedes were in a phase of expansion. But that doesn't mean the peasant animosity against the nobility wasn't a factor in the war. It most certainly was. This is visible not least in the large number of noble estates that were attacked, pillaged and burned by irate peasants. But to say that it was some kind of proto-nationalistic uprising would probably be taking it a bit far. Another indication that the peasants' anger was more class-based than nationalistic is that not all noble estates were attacked and destroyed. One notable exception is the estate belonging to Karin Månsdotter. Remember her? She was queen for a few weeks in episode 81, after marrying King Erik XIV, before he was ousted by his brothers. You may remember that she was given an estate in Finland after Erik's death, and there she lived a comfortable life of privileged obscurity. But even though she was now a wealthy lady, she didn't forget that she had been born into a poor peasant family, and so she was always made sure that the peasants living and working on her estate were well taken care of. Thanks to treating her employees and renters like human beings, she was spared the wrath of the rebellious peasants during the Cudgel War. Anyway, the actual fighting began with an incident at Isokyrö church in late November 1596. A man named Jaakko Ilkka was elected leader of the rebellion. He was a prominent local man, the owner of a large farm, and he even dabbled in trade. Ilkka even owned a ship and had sailed on Stockholm and Reval before. In addition, the choice of Ilkka made sense since he had some prior military experience, having served in the cavalry in the early 1590s. In December 1596, groups of peasants moved south from where the rebellion had started in western Finland. Jaakko Ilkka commanded the main force, but they were beaten on New Year's Eve 1596 at a place called Nokia. Yes, exactly like the cell phone. Fleming offered the defeated peasants the opportunity to return home in peace if they just handed over their leader to him. But Jaakko Ilkka managed to escape. Only a few days later, though, he was arrested, possibly after having been betrayed by some peasants who just wanted to return home. Or maybe they were bribed by Fleming, who knows. Ilkka was executed and his dead body left on display outside the church in Isokyrö, where the cudgel war had begun. Since Ilkka had escaped, Fleming's original offer of clemency wasn't on the table anymore. The remaining peasant troops tried to flee, but several hundred of them were cut down by Fleming's troops as they were running for their lives. Also, the peasants who'd reached Tavastia were beaten by the professional soldiers that were sent to put down the rebellion. Also, these defeated peasants were promised amnesty if they laid down their weapons. But as soon as they did so, the soldiers attacked, massacring hundreds of defenseless peasants. On January 23rd, yet another similar massacre took place in St. Michael in southeastern Finland. Also there, a defeated peasant force surrendered after having been promised clemency, but as soon as they had handed over their weapons, they were cut down. Even though the peasants who had marched south had met such grim fates, another wave of rebellious peasants started to rise up further to the north, encouraged by Duke Karl reiterating his promise to send support from Sweden. As these fresh rebel troops moved south, more and more peasants joined their ranks. But Fleming and his cavalry rode out to meet them, and on February 24th he managed to convince the Swedish-speaking peasants among the rebels to abandon their cause and to join his side instead. At that point, the end result was a foregone conclusion. But unlike the previous defeats, there was no massacre this time. The leaders of the rebellions were taken to Turku, though, where they were executed. In the end, despite Duke Karl's best efforts to keep the cudgel war going, it only took Claes Fleming and his soldiers a few months to crush the rebellion. But the Finnish commander didn't get to savor the sweet taste of victory for very long, because he died, of unrelated reasons, shortly thereafter, in April 1597. When Claes Fleming died, Duke Karl could finally take control over the eastern part of the realm, and that fall, when Finland had been taken over by his troops, he visited Turku. At Turku Castle, a famous, or perhaps infamous, incident took place. Claes Fleming was still lying in state, and Duke Karl stepped up to the corpse of his old antagonist, grabbed Fleming by the beard, shook it, and said, "If you'd still be alive, your head wouldn't be safe on your shoulders." To this, Fleming's widow, who was witnessing the scene, replied dryly, "If my husband had still been alive, your grace wouldn't have gained entry to the castle in the first place." The event has been immortalized in a national romantic painting from 1878 by the Finnish artist Albert Edelfelt. Claes Fleming may have escaped Karl's wrath by dying, but many of the noblemen who'd supported Fleming and King Sigismund against the Duke weren't as lucky. In 1599, dozens of people were executed following what can only be described as show trials in what posterity remembers as the Turku and Viborg bloodbaths. In parallel, many peasants took the opportunity to exact their revenge for the brutal way the cudgel war had been crushed by attacking more noble estates in Finland. After having pacified Finland, Duke Karl now had de facto control over the whole kingdom. But on the other side of the Baltic Sea, in Poland, King Sigismund hadn't been sitting on his hands. He wasn't prepared to give up the Swedish crown without a fight, and as the cudgel war was winding down, he managed to get the Polish parliament to agree to let him go to Sweden again in 1598. Once again, the Poles let the king go on condition that he made the visit brief and that he'd return home with Estonia this time. Sigismund agreed to the terms and started to raise troops. He also commandeered ships in the Prussian port cities along the southern coast of the Baltic Sea in order to transport said troops to Sweden. His Polish advisors counseled that he should bring a large force to Sweden to deal Uncle Karl a decisive blow and put an end to the conflict once and for all. But they weren't the only ones advising the king. Some members of the Council of the Realm had fled Karl's rule in Sweden and joined the lawful king. They cautioned that too many foreign troops wouldn't go down well in Sweden. Instead of the lawful king taking back what was his from an illegitimate usurper, people might see a large foreign army on Swedish soil as a hostile invasion. They may even turn to Karl to protect them. Image-wise, it didn't help that the Vatican followed the conflict between Sigismund and Karl with great interest. The Catholic Church hoped that a victory for the king would lead to a reintroduction of Catholicism in Sweden, and that would be a boon to the Catholic cause in the wider context of the brewing conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Europe. The Pope hoped that the Swedish naval power could be used as a Catholic counterweight against England, aiding Spain in making the high seas a Catholic domain. The Vatican had even suggested that Sigismund hand over Elfsborg Castle to the Spanish to give them a naval base from which to threaten England from the north. But before any fortifications could be handed over to foreign powers, Sigismund needed to win the war against his uncle. In July, the king was ready and set off across the Baltic Sea with some 9,000 German, Polish, Hungarian, and Croatian soldiers. That was a large force, not least in comparison to what Uncle Karl managed to scrape together. Karl could only raise a few thousand men to begin with. Sigismund and his multinational army reached Sweden on July 30th, and his first objective was to take Kalmar, the key port city in southeastern Sweden. The king took the city without any incident. Strengthened by this initial success, he reached out to his uncle Karl to settle their differences peacefully. But Karl refused to sit down and talk. If Sigismund wanted Sweden back, he'd have to fight for it. So the king left a garrison in Kalmar and continued to sail up the coast. He sent a part of his fleet along to Stockholm, but personally he took a detour to Stegeborg, a castle on the coast some 200 kilometers north of Kalmar. His sister lived there, and Sigismund apparently wanted to catch up with her before he continued the war. When Uncle Karl caught wind of Sigismund's stopover at his sister's, and that he had only brought a small force with him, Karl hoped to trap the king there and catch Sigismund by surprise before he had a chance to organize his troops properly. So on September 8th, Karl attacked. But the battle turned out to be a defeat for Karl, who was forced to retreat from the battlefield. With his back against the wall, he sent a message to his nephew, the king, telling him that he had changed his mind and that he was now willing to negotiate a settlement to end the conflict. Sigismund was happy to receive this message and readily agreed to sit down and talk with his uncle. But it soon turned out that Uncle Karl had no intention whatsoever to negotiate. It had just been a trick to make sure Sigismund didn't drive home his advantage and to give Karl time to reorganize his defeated troops. Instead of chasing after Karl, Sigismund had brought his army to Linköping, west of Stegeborg. On September 25th, Uncle Karl dropped the pretense when he tried to spring a surprise attack on Sigismund at dawn. But guards stationed on the bridge across the stream just east of the city noticed Karl's troops getting ready for battle in the pre-dawn mist and sounded the alarm. Sigismund's troops managed to react on time and streamed out of the city to face Karl's forces. Karl's plan had failed, and Sigismund's troops soon got the upper hand on the battlefield as well. At that point, Uncle Karl yet again sent a message to Sigismund asking to negotiate. The king accepted the offer, again, and ordered his troops to return to the city across the bridge. But as soon as his soldiers withdrew and were caught in an unfavorable position, crowded onto the bridge and between the stream and the city walls, Karl ordered a renewed attack. The fighting was fierce, but this time Karl was successful and the king's army was defeated. Now, after he had finally won a battle and had the upper hand militarily, Uncle Karl was really ready to negotiate with Sigismund. At that point, King Sigismund had to give in to Karl's demands, make him steward, dissolve his army, and hand over the members of the council who had fled to Sigismund in Poland. These hapless noblemen would later be executed by Karl for the heinous crime of remaining loyal to the lawful king. In addition to all this, Sigismund also promised to travel to Stockholm, where a permanent arrangement for how Karl should rule in his absence would be agreed upon at an upcoming Riksdag. But Sigismund hardly had time to sign the agreement before he broke it. He left troops in Kalmar to have a bridgehead in Sweden, and then he returned to Poland to raise a new army to send across the Baltic Sea the following year to show his uncle who was in charge. Nothing came of those plans, though, because Kalmar fell to Karl before Sigismund had a chance to send his new army to Sweden. As we covered a few minutes ago, Finland, the last remaining major part of the kingdom that still sided with Sigismund, also fell to Karl at this time. At the Riksdag in 1599, held in Stockholm in July, Sigismund was declared deposed. The legality was backed up by referring to the Kalmar Constitution, ironically a document no one had claimed to be valid or legally binding up until that point. Another awkward fact was that Sigismund actually had a younger brother called John, who was a Lutheran and who lived in Sweden. And, most importantly, John was ahead of Karl in the line of succession. But Uncle Karl pressured the young Prince John to decline the offer of taking the crown, which instead went to Karl. He pretended to demur and remained steward of the realm for a few years, but in 1604 he accepted the crown that the Riksdag had offered to him and was declared to be King Karl IX of Sweden. Much like in the case of his older brother, the number 9 was based purely on fantasy, made up by that exiled archbishop Johannes Magnus half a century earlier. But it did give the impression that Sweden had a long and glorious history, so everyone just went along with it, even though Johannes Magnus had been a Catholic. So Uncle Karl was now king of Sweden. He'd waited a long time for this, and he was no longer a young man. In fact, he was already in his 50s, so he didn't waste any time. He had ideas, a vision for the future of Sweden, and he wanted to get as much as possible done before he died. He started his reign by exacting revenge on those who'd supported Sigismund. We've already talked about the executions in Finland and in Linköping, but he also ousted the archbishop, who was imprisoned. The archbishop hadn't supported the Catholic Sigismund per se, but he'd failed to back up Karl sufficiently, at least in Karl's own opinion. All Catholics were also expelled from the country, and practicing Catholicism became a capital offence in Sweden. The fighting between Sigismund and Karl deepened the religious divide in Sweden, and helped turn Lutheranism, or perhaps more accurately, anti-Catholicism, into a key element of Swedish national identity. The anti-Catholic sentiment would survive for a long time, and it'll even grow stronger in future episodes. Even after Swedes were no longer executed for becoming Catholics, they would still be expelled from the country if they joined the Roman Catholic Church. That law was abolished in 1873, when it became legal for Swedish citizens to convert to Catholicism. But only in 1951 were Catholics allowed to become government ministers, teachers, or nurses in Sweden. The head of state, that is the monarch, still must be raised in the Church of Sweden, and any member of the Swedish royal family who leaves the church automatically loses their place in the line of succession and is no longer eligible for the job as king or queen. But let's go back to King Karl IX and his vision for Sweden. He did much for the country's economy by encouraging industry and agriculture. For instance, he decided that anyone who would cultivate unused crown land would not only be given this land for free, but also be exempt from taxes for 6 years. This broadened the tax base in the long run. Karl IX also reformed the legal system by including religious law in the penal code. Based on biblical sources, it now became a capital offense to curse, to commit adultery, or having gay sex, to practice witchcraft, and even to fail honoring one's parents. The new king wasn't just interested in passing new legislation, though. He also took an interest in how the law was applied in practice. There's a famous story of a widow who had failed to win a case in court, and who in her desperation turned to the king. He reviewed her case and sent her back to the court with a message to the judge scribbled on the back of her documents saying, "If you don't rule in favor of this poor woman, I'll have you beaten." To be honest, I'm not sure that actually happened. I mean, it sounds a little too good to be true. But it is true that Karl IX acted resolutely against corruption. He made sure to hang several bailiffs and governors, and the king supposedly said that anyone who'd worked as a tax collector for 6 years could be hanged without wasting time on an investigation or a trial, because they were all guilty of corruption in one form or another. Karl's foreign policy was focused on war, primarily with Poland, which isn't surprising considering the circumstances of how he became king. For the rest of his life, Karl IX would have a war going in the Baltics, either against Poland or Russia. All this fighting in the east made him blind to another threat. Despite repeated warnings from the Council of the Realm, Karl IX ignored the situation south of the border. He would soon have reason to regret that decision. Next time, we'll talk more about that. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast, even if you were rooting for Sigismund in his war against Uncle Karl. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from Odin's Lifehack Collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Havamal, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as, "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop, or if you just crave more content, at least vaguely related to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer Twitter, or X as it's called these days, then you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That's S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.